We also have other sports now, including things like PBR that was really not on our radar. So professional bull riding of all things. But I mean, they're really...
I was going to say Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Right? Yeah, well, it's no coincidence that that beer is very popular in that sport.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. If you are attending SBC Summit North America, make sure to visit the Optimove stand at the event in New Jersey from May 7th to 9th, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
What is up, everybody? I am Jason Trost, the host of the Business of Betting podcast. Today, I am joined for episode 211 with the CEO and founder of Alt Sports Data. His name is Joe Dunnigan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jason. Happy to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Good to see you.
Yeah, so today we're going to jump into the world of data. Data is one of those things that I guess with hindsight, it's kind of obvious, but it's one of those, you know, areas in sports betting that has become exploded, notably with BetGenius and BetRadar and kind of the big boys. And if I understand correctly, you're trying to carve out a niche for alternative sports, you know, surfing, skateboarding, those kinds of things. So why don't we jump right in? Why don't you talk about where the genesis came from and what your motivation is to do this space?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Jason. In honesty, so I have a background in gaming. I grew up in it, worked in it domestically and abroad for a number of years, and left it to follow my other passion, which was action sports, which is anything with a board under my feet, skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing. Spent a number of years building businesses and brands in and around the space, and was always kind of frustrated by the fact that I'd go to Vegas for Final Four and with my friends, and I just didn't have anything that was interesting to me to bet on. I grew up in horse racing, and so I could find that in droves, but I would look around and go, I'm not into big four sports. I'm just not a basketball, football, baseball fan. And so it was a bit of a head scratcher. And I spent the last few years prior to starting this at GoPro, where I worked with my now co-founder, Todd Ballard, who was the CMO. And we kind of looked at each other and said the same thing. It's like, you know, sports betting's blowing up. We know these sports and these spaces really well. We've been in them for decades and we've built our lives and careers and raised our families around them. And which is, they were underrepresented in this space, and it was a total head scratcher to us because they're, you know, massive global communities with deep engagement. They drive a lot of social content, a lot of cultural influence, and they just didn't exist in sports betting. I mean, they're Olympic sports. They've got decades of history. And so a friend of mine goes, well, why don't you go solve that? And I was like, oh my God, please. I had to go to my wife and beg for forgiveness before I even started. And we were like, okay, let's look into it. And I was fortunate enough to reconnect with an old friend at Penn named Chris McElane, who runs racing operations. And he reintroduced me to Joe Asher, who I had grown up in parallel with at Brandywine Raceway many years prior. And Joe was kind enough to dig in with me on a handful of sit-downs one-on-one and kind of guide me back into the industry, quite frankly. Introduced me to Benji Cherniak, Neil Dealey from Radar, so many other folks, Chris Grove. And we just kind of were like, okay, we can't start a sports book. We didn't have the resources. We did have a vision for that. Hey, there's a big new potential audience out there. Let's start a sports book around it. And they were like, no, provide the data because that will unlock that opportunity for the industry. And so, you know, we had to go very student mode, ground up, and kind of go, where do we even start? And, you know, we've been hacking our way through it for 3 years and it's going really well. We've gone out and secured 20 league rights deals with some of the most iconic sports in and around action and alternative sports. We've built a team and a trading platform, and we now provide odds and pricing data to some of the larger operators in the world. And we also provide demand generation services. So not on, you know, maybe a little bit unlike a Radar or Genius who lead with data, we've provided the data as almost, and I say this is a necessary evil of sorts, in that that's what unlocks the opportunity to drive demand and drive new customers. And that's really the model, is it's demand generation first, but that opportunity to engage new customers in meaningful new ways is unlocked through the provisioning of that data. So that's a long, I know I just kind of combined about 14 different concepts in one, but that's a little bit of the background and a little bit about sort of how we do it and what we do.
Excellent job name dropping.
I'm super good at that.
Well, let's jump in. So, you know, one of the misconceptions that I hear when I tell people I'm into sports betting, I do sports betting, and the Olympics are coming up. Everybody thinks that the Olympics are going to be a big thing to bet on. And at least where I'm sitting and all my 15 years experience, nobody wants to bet in the Olympics. And I have various theories for that, largely around betting is very cultural. You sort of like, A, it needs to be cultural. B, it sort of needs to be repeatable. C, you need to have an opinion about it. And, you know, unless it's Usain Bolt in the Olympics, very few people have an opinion on who's going to win. Yeah. So how does that map to surfing? Because I don't think there's any betting. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I doubt there's a very strong betting culture around surfing. So it kind of sounds like there's not a market here for these alternative sports. Like, where do I have that wrong?
No, I think it's correct. It's been underrepresented for a lot of years. And it's funny, I was thinking about it in anticipation of our conversation. And I started thinking about, you know, back to the early days of the NFL and the MLB and the NBA. And it was like, they were the alternative sport way back when, right? They were the alternative to horse racing. They were alternative to other forms of gaming and parimutuel and whatever. And over time, they've grown in popularity and they've, you know, obviously become what they are today. And they represent whatever 3/4 of GGR in the US. And I think, you know, these sports have a similar potential. In and of themselves, today, they represent such a small fraction of the opportunity. But what we've taken is really a platform and portfolio approach and said, hey, let's take and get 20 of the biggest ones and let's aggregate them. And let's take and unlock the opportunity there. But we see them as acquisition tools. We see them as a way to engage new, relevant, youthful, potentially very high value audiences to sports betting. But in and of themselves, we're very upfront with our operating partners and everybody is these aren't going to generate massive amounts of handle right away. And inarguably, they present a little bit of a burden to the operators in some ways because they are they're lightly sophisticated markets. There's not a lot of history or context there. There's not a lot of domain expertise, but that's what we bring to the market is, you know, decades of history commercializing these audiences, building community around them, driving engagement. And the way that we do that in this space is provisioning of odds and pricing data, which allows legal wagering on them through some of the largest operators in the space.
Am I understanding that your hypothesis is that it's kind of long tail lead gen, like the 100%. Super fan who's into, well, you know, the guy who's into surfing, but also like soccer will... That's your gateway drug? Or is your hypothesis that in 10 years, surfing is going to be as big as baseball and people want to bet on it?
Definitely more the former. And it's a little bit bidirectional, I guess you would say, is there's an access point through a sport like surfing that happens to be very relevant to a subset of the world that may or may not be interested in big four sports. So that's one component. The other component is there are folks who are in there, you know, betting today who have downtime, there's soft shoulder seasons, there's day parts that are not being addressed. There might be just an interest in differentiation and mixing it up a little bit. So we see the primary value as bringing new audiences and engaging them and having them, they may spend 20 cents on the dollar on our sports and then 80 cents on the dollar on big four sports. But there's also the existing bettors who may come back the other way and say, look, I need something new and interesting and exciting to bet on. So we do think there's opportunity on both sides of that, and it's playing out that way.
Got it. One of the things, going back to the UK as an example, not just the Olympics, but rugby is a fairly popular sport. You know it, people watch it. Six Nations is quite big. But relative to the popularity of the sport, the betting is very small at rugby. So I'm sure, you know, it's similar dynamics in some of the sports you cover. Besides surfing, what are sort of the top three or four sports that you cover?
So when we started out, my partner, Todd Ballard, set out a list of, you know, the tier one of what we call the tier 2.5. And it was World Surf League. It was Street League Skateboarding, Supercross. We also have other sports now, including things like PBR that was really not on our radar. So professional bull riding of all things. But I mean, they're really...
I was going to say Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's no coincidence that beer is very popular in that sport. But yeah, no, they are... You could bucket them in motorsports, action sports, outdoor sports, and endurance sports, I guess, are kind of the way we tend to bucket them. And then there's also combat sports, which we're getting more deeply involved in. We've got a deal with Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship. We just signed a deal with the NHRA, the National Hot Rod Association. So it's an interesting mix of sports from a variety of different sub verticals. But what's interesting is you start thinking about them in aggregate, and their social audiences alone eclipse the NHL in terms of reach and engagement. They're driving 15 billion impressions a year. So there's 64 million social followers. And all of a sudden you go, holy shit, there's something here. There's something very meaningful. And so quantitatively, there's a lot, but then qualitatively, there's real value in these audiences in that they are risk tolerant by definition. They are tend to be more youthful, more educated, higher net worth, and are already betting, even though their primary interest sports are not present in sports betting today, except through us. They're already betting with greater frequency and volume than their counterparts who are more passive fans of larger sports. And we think that part of that has to do with the participatory nature of these sports. So unlike something that I'm just a passive consumer of, and that's not to diminish the intensity and the value of, you know, NFL fans or NBA fans, whatever. It's the idea that when I define myself as a skateboarder, surfer, snowboarder, whatever it is, the likelihood of me wanting another point of access to that and my passion for that comes through in my engagement, my ability and my desire to have a stake in the outcome of those events. So it's interesting. We have that dynamic, which I think is unique. But the other dynamic is that these sports can also be a bit exclusive in that sometimes there's a geographical barrier or a financial barrier or a physical barrier. Like I can't actually snowboard, but there are audiences that surround the sports that really are seeking access and a reason or an opportunity to be part of the conversation. And we believe that by giving them an opportunity to have a stake in the outcome, that opens that up. So we see it as TAM expanding for the industry, but also TAM expanding for these sports themselves.
So zooming out a little bit, looking at Radar and Genius, I think we pay low single digit millions for sports data and, you know, largely through Genius and Radar. And it's just getting more and more expensive. And as an operator, I'm incredibly frustrated with the space. I think there's this kind of bad dynamic going on where the leagues see how they can monetize betting through charging a lot for official data rights. These guys buy it, they pass on the charges. Combined with the fact that I think a lot of startups and smaller betting operators are getting shaken out of the industry. So the number of players is shrinking. The expense for the data is getting more expensive, and I hate it, you know. And if I had to go back in the time machine, I might have started a data company if I had known how sort of gold dusty this thing was going to become. I guess my question jumping into it is, if I wanted to start a data company, like, I guess you said you have official partnerships with 20 providers or something like that. Why do you need that? Like, why can't you just send a college kid to the match and have him be there with an iPad so you don't have to pay? Because I assume you have rev share or payment pay for data deals with these 20 leagues. Why do you have to do that?
Well, one, the business of data aggregation is not one that we really want to be in. And that process is pretty unwieldy and a tough one, as you can imagine, logistically and operationally. But so when we do league rights deals, one of the first points of analysis is, you know, how sophisticated is our data? How easily can we ingest it through their API? You know, do they have a solid data capture, you know, mechanism in place? So we don't tend to work in that piece of the business. And then in terms of, you know, why do we have, well, I guess to your point is the dynamic of paying massive fees for data rights, and I understand how that gets transferred to the cost basis for the operator. With our leagues, because they are emerging, they don't really have a position to charge those kind of fees. So we partner with them. And uniquely, the way that we partner with our leagues is for their official event and athlete data, which allows us to provide odds and pricing. But more, I guess, interestingly, is we partner with them for their customer bases. So when we do a deal with, say, the World Surf League or Street League Skateboarding, there's 27 million skateboarders. I mean, there's 27 million surfers in the world. There's 85 million skateboarders in the world. Street League has unique access to these audiences. And when we partner with them for their data and their customer data, we go arm in arm with the leagues to drive demand to our operating partners. And we share in those revenues with the leagues. So it's much more of a partnered approach and much more of a leveraged approach than us just writing big checks. And so because of that, the leagues are super motivated. We're super motivated. We're very well aligned in terms of our goals and objectives. And that is to drive high value new customers to our operating partners, so that they can bet on their sports. And this, the leagues themselves because they really have a lot to prove and a lot to gain through being available in sports betting. They are super motivated to do so because, again, it's TAM expanding for them, and then it deepens the engagement with their existing customers. So they see it as much more of a strategic opportunity.
Okay, so I naively thought you did the data origination piece, but it sounds like you don't do that at all. So then you're kind of like, you're more like a broker, I guess you would call it. So you're connecting operators to leagues, and you're like the middleman that sits between them.
We're a lot like a marketplace. I mean, we sit in the middle of this massive and growing demand for leagues wanting access to sports betting. And then at the same time, the operators are seeking cost-effective new ways of providing new and differentiated relevant product and profitable ways of acquiring new high-value customers and then retaining them. So if you think about the three business metrics of, you know, cost of acquisition, the ability to cost-effectively stand up new and differentiated product, and then lifetime value by retention, where we attempt to impact both the supply and demand challenges we witness coming back into the industry after a lot of years.
So how do you connect the 27 million skater database or the surfer database to the operator? You sit in the middle and you are sending referral links back.
Yeah, and the piece I haven't mentioned is, so a third leg of the stool for us is really this owned media platform called NXT Bets. We've stood up an owned and operated media platform that has originally provided a compliance layer for our sub-affiliate partners. So each of our league partners functions as somewhat of they're a sub-affiliate to ours. And so they're driving demand to custom landing pages on NextBets, says, you know, go bet on surfing. And then in the offers from all of our operating partners with whom we have affiliate deals, they're going through to sign up and bet on their sports there.
Got it. And how are you handling the pricing piece? Are you doing that yourself? Are you a broker for that as well?
No, we do that ourselves. We have an in-house trading team. We built a proprietary trading platform of our own from the ground up when we first started, because there really wasn't one that was focused or that addressed the nuances of these sports. And yeah, we have a trading platform, trading team, and we're doing the odds and pricing and the managed pricing services ourselves.
How much money have you guys raised and how big's the company right now?
We've raised in two rounds, $4.5 million. We're very small. We're still sub 10 full-time employees, and we've got, you know, another 10, 15 fractional employees, but very lean and mean, trying to, you know, keep hacking away and figuring it out. But we were live on DraftKings for 9 months last year. We launched 6 new sports that had never been live and legal in the United States before with some, you know, pretty impressive results. And we just went live with FanDuel. We have a deal with Underdog Fantasy that we launched a couple of weeks ago. So we've been live on Betfred and Betway for about a year now. So we're getting there. It's a process, as you know.
I don't know if you guys are remote or in an office, but 10 people around a table, that's like the ideal size for a startup.
I love it. We can move fast, break a lot of stuff.
Are you guys remote or in person?
We're both. We're about half of us are in North County, San Diego, and then the others are remote in various locations.
Got it. Best weather in the world.
Not today, but yeah, normally it is.
Yeah, somebody from San Diego can never say you're having bad weather. So, you know, I get this is a little bit out of your wheelhouse, but what I'm seeing in sort of the big four, I guess, the major sports, is the data is becoming so expensive. They're starting to become a business model for pirating data. And I guess to get your commentary on it as somebody from the industry, what do you think is going to happen? Because I don't see data getting cheaper, because I think, you know, between the cable fees going down and people paying less attention to sports and, you know, there's this weird economic dynamic where, you know, most people are watching YouTube these days. Most people aren't. What I'm talking about is a standard cable bundle that, you know, every cable operator used to pay ESPN $4 a month or something for all that. And then ESPN would go buy right to the NFL, blah, blah, blah. But that whole model is crumbling as people are cord cutting. Now they're trying to look to betting to up the revenues. That dynamic that was happening where the data company is paying too much for the data, they're passing that on to the operators. Now the operators are incentivized to go get pirated data. Where do you think this all is going to shake out in the next 10 years?
It's tough to say. I mean, I think that you have to add value any way that you can. And I think for us, we've always believed that we're building an operating system that opens up an entirely new audience and brings it to sports betting and data provisioning, and the provisioning of odds and pricing and managed pricing services is one component of it. But if you think about what we're building in aggregate, it's really a gateway and a pipeline for all these new, you know, I say new, these underrepresented leagues to come into sports betting that really doesn't exist today, because they're coming in and they're starting with, hey, you know, Genius or hey, Radar or hey, whoever, please take our sport. And they're saying, well, go to Alt Sports because they'll help you and they'll put you into their pipeline, bring it to the industry. So I think that there is downward pressure on data pricing that'll continue to exist. But I think it's how do you add value in multiple ways to your operating partners? And for us, it's the helping them with supply, helping them with demand, and then providing a media platform that not only drives that, you know, serves as a compliance layer, but also educates the consumer, stimulates betting, and really starts to kind of close the loop on the flywheel that we're creating. So it's really an operating system more so than just a provisioning of data. So it places a slightly lesser amount of pressure on the pricing of data for us. But as far as
a very clever way to sidestep the question.
No, I'm sorry. No, I was trying to loop back to it. But yeah, as far as the short answer is, I have no idea what's going to happen in 10 years to the price of data. But to your point, I think that there's downward pressure on it. And wherever there's not enough perceived value, there's going to be people seeking that value and they'll squeeze margin out anywhere they can.
Yeah. I'm curious because it feels unsustainable. Same sort of like the sports model with TV rights and all that kind of stuff also feels unsustainable. But we'll see what happens. I'm finding myself, I spend more and more of my day on YouTube just because it gives me what I want. I pay for the premium, so there's no ads. It's an amazing product and the depth of stuff on there. And I just find myself either linear TV or even I'm watching more YouTube than Netflix, you know, all the streaming services just because it's faster and I don't have to worry about what I'm going to watch. So I'm kind of curious how that's going to affect live sports.
Well, I've been thinking about this in the context of AI too. It's like, so I'll make one comment about YouTube, and it's interesting because we used to cite it a lot because as I ran global brand strategy for GoPro, Todd was a CMO. Between GoPro's YouTube channel and Red Bull's, they were two of the top five YouTube channels in the world. And they were built on the back of the content that is created around the sports that we're bringing. And so that was a bit of an eye-opener to us. We're like, there's this massive global following. There's this really widely shared aspirational lifestyle content that is generated from within these sports, and yet it doesn't exist in sports betting. So that was a little bit of the impetus for kind of why we started it. But then as it relates to content more broadly, it just seems like it's becoming so commoditized. So to your point, you know, it's like, okay, it's everywhere and it's cheap and getting cheaper. So why would I pay for it? I think is kind of what I heard you say. And the optimist in me says it drives more interest in live sports, right? Because they're like almost the only thing that's irreplicable in terms of their, I'm not the only thing, but it's really hard. I mean, you can create an animated movie about anything, but how do you create or replicate the outcome of a live sporting event, right? So I just feel like that commoditization, increased commoditization of content is going to favor live sports. And again, that's maybe just the optimist in me. And I feel like because of that, or in part because of that, there's a growing demand for new and relevant live sports content. And we're bringing a pile of that to the industry. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's just kind of what was going through my head.
I mean, it could be our generation, you know, like we grew up with live sports and there wasn't that much. When I was a kid, baseball, you were talking about this sports changing. Baseball is such a big deal. I checked the paper and, you know, I can't remember the last time somebody mentioned a baseball game. No, I feel like the kids these days don't care about like sports as much. So I'm just like our generation's going to keep watching it and it's going to be a big part of our lives. But I feel like whatever generation Z or A that we're up to, that I don't think they're going to watch it that much.
Yeah, I think it depends on the sport is my bias. And I think that's the thing is it's distributed. I feel like there's this kind of democratization coming, not to get into the politics question again, but this sort of, I have a sense that there is an opportunity to, it's kind of trickling down from this tip of spear pinnacle of four sports. It feels not unlike music to me. You know, you think of the olden days when there were gatekeepers and there were a handful of super groups and mega bands. And then with the democratization of it via technology and marketplaces and iTunes and everything else, people get access to what they really truly want. And there aren't the gatekeepers any longer. And I think that's what's opening up the opportunity for all of these other alternative sports and these niches. You know, they say there's riches in the niches. And that's the world that we've always come from, is the idea that let's go narrow and deep in these really passionate slivers and let's offer a bunch of them. And that's what we feel like we're bringing to the industry.
Do you have kids?
I do. Yeah. Two boys, 30 and 24.
They probably watch live sports, but I was wondering if you had like teenagers or something. I would be curious if they watch. Do your kids watch sports?
You know, my older one, interestingly, is now a baseball fan, but they both grew up skateboarding, snowboarding, surfing. And those are the sports that our kids were raised on. And I've been to maybe 3 football games in my life, you know, and I've been in the sports industry for many years, but I've never been interested in big 4 sports.
Yeah. But if they're into skateboarding, does that mean they're watching a live thing? Are they looking at YouTube clips on skateboarding after and to look at the highlights and stuff like that?
More of the latter. I mean, they're definitely, you know, watching, whether it be Pipe Masters for surfing or Street League skateboarding. But yeah, I think to your point, it's digestible bite-sized clips wherever they can find them.
So pivoting to entrepreneurship, you know, you've had a pretty interesting and long career. I'm curious what it's like to start a business at this stage of your life. I think in popular culture, we're used to like 20-year-olds or 18-year-olds dropping out of college to start businesses. But like, what's it feel like to have the experience and to take the risk at the stage of life that you're at?
It's awesome, actually, because you don't realize. I mean, I started my first startup was in my late 20s with my college roommate. We started the first e-commerce provider in action sports with $2,000 on a credit card and out of my guest house. And we didn't know anything. I mean, we knew like less than nothing. And we had some really wild times and some success, but we were just faking it in so many ways. And we just didn't have the benefit of a lot of hindsight. And so coming into this now with the benefit of a great deal of hindsight, it's helpful. But I'm a terminal student, and I came into this. The challenge was I'd been out of it for 20 years, out of gaming. And I didn't know much about anything we were getting into other than the audiences and the sports and the space that surrounds the opportunity. So it's been cool. It's been a great experience. I've been super grateful to have this really warm re-welcoming coming back into the industry. I found it to be much more open and collaborative and, like I said, welcoming than I had anticipated. But no, it's great. I think if I'm not building something, I'm just unhappy. So that's really what this has been about for me. And in part, if I'm being honest, you know, I had a lot of responsibility with parents and kids prior. And now on the other side of that, I've got time and capacity and some resources and a little bit of knowledge in my background. And it's been super fun, and it's been great. It's a great opportunity to re-engage and stay, I guess, relevant with emerging trends. So, yeah.
With the youthful kids. Well, I think it's awesome in two fronts. It's really nice to see people in the later stages of their career start a business, because I think the world needs more entrepreneurs, and the more innovation, things people trying things, I mean, the better. You know, the amount of people that still stay in companies for too long that just kind of don't think of ways to push the world forward is too much. And I'd love to see more entrepreneurship. The other thing is, in sports betting, I think for a long time, at least from where I've sat, there's just not as much entrepreneurship in sports betting as you would see in sort of other industries. I think it's because of the stigma around it and the barriers to entry. Mm. You know, it's much easier to start a chat bot that you can do globally than getting into a regulated industry that can be seen as, I don't know, niche from the outside. So I think it's great that you've done both those things. So it's a really nice story. And I can be skeptical of a lot of startups, I definitely see the hypothesis and the niche and the, I often think back to the Amazon long tail strategy where they wanted to make sure that they had every book in their catalog, even though nobody's going to buy the rare book. The time that somebody wants to buy the rare book, you know, when they buy Harry Potter, you want them to buy it from Amazon because they had the rare book. And it sounds a lot like that's your strategy. Like anytime somebody's curious about the odds of some skateboard match, even though if they're not going to bet on it, when the Super Bowl comes around, they're going to think to use that bookmaker.
That's an interesting parallel. I've thought about that a lot because actually it dates me a lot. But when we started our e-commerce provider, it was the same era of Amazon. And we have a similar view that we really want to get our arms around this entire category. And we've got a good start on it, but it's massive and it's growing. And we see it as a way to really differentiate for a lot of operators and provide that new relevant content in much the same way that a retailer, like you say, Amazon, you're defined by what you carry, right? Like as a retailer, you're as good as the products that you sell and at what price point and what margin and how you merchandise them. I think operators have a similar opportunity right now because differentiation is so hard to find in this space, right? And so what we've been pleasantly surprised to see is how some operators embrace a certain subset of our sports and others will embrace a different subset. And by doing so, they drive points of competitive difference between themselves. And I feel like that's part of our opportunity is to help them to compete with one another, right? And in a market that maybe is starting to, the horizontal expansion might be slowing a bit and the need to go deeper is starting to become greater as the, you know, fewer and fewer new states are coming online. And so our ability to provide them with points of competitive difference, brand equity, brand premium, those are things that we get excited about helping our customers with because we're marketing guys at the end of the day. That's where we started. And the data and a lot of the detail around it are, they're necessary to enable those opportunities for our operating partners.
Before I let you go, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I don't know. A teacher at some point, maybe. I'd love hanging out with young people all the time. I learn as much from them as they've ever learned from me. But yeah, I'd love to teach at some point in my life. I wrote a book not long ago about growing up on the backstretch of racetracks all over the country. So maybe a writer, but I don't know. I'll just keep guessing and hacking my way through it, Jason.
Very good. Well, thanks for stopping by and I really enjoyed the chat.
Likewise, Jason. Really appreciate the time and thanks for having me on.
Cheers. All the best.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. If you are attending SBC Summit North America, make sure to visit the Optimove stand at the event in New Jersey from May 7th to 9th. And we'll look forward to seeing you there.